Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, November 4th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, and Ask Catherine, then a discussion with John Laughlin on a deeper look at the European Union and the future of the euro. Fascinating, fascinating interview. And let's go to the movies, Charles Ferguson's new documentary, Inside Job. If you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend it. It's about the systemic use of fraudulent mortgage finance and a housing bubble to steal literally trillions of dollars. Some great interviews. Our theme tonight is the smite button cometh. I have a whole series of members of our network who will talk about the smite button. And the smite button is the thing that kind of hits you. You get smited, and it makes you take stop and look at what's going on and say, you know, something's wrong. Let's leave the official reality and let's start to look at what Catherine Fitz calls the real deal. And what's about to happen now with the election over is that for those who are not repositioned or who are just plain lucky, the smite button is going to start hitting a lot of people. It's going to start coming home steadily. And before this is over, we're going to go through a transition here. It's going to reach almost everyone. Well, Money and Markets, the big story is the American elections just over. It's important to understand what we just saw. You saw tremendous anger and concern from the general population. You saw real fear in the parties that the population is sort of very angry at both of them. A real effort by a variety of people to take advantage of the incumbents, replace the incumbents. And the results we saw were very, very mixed. For example, Russ Feingold in Wisconsin, a senator with an incredible record voting against the bailout, doing a lot of things that, in fact, the Tea Party members would love, getting voted out. And then Andrew Cuomo, one of the worst perpetrators of the housing bubble. If you're going to, you know, if I was going to pick my top five people who engineered the housing bubble, Cuomo would be on that list. So he gets elected governor of New York. And, you know, so very kind of mixed results. We see the professionals using what started off as a grassroots movement with the Tea Party to come on in and do a variety of other things that have nothing to do with what the original Tea Parties are really about. We've seen here, I've been out in Silicon Valley and so out on the coast, we see chatter on the coast of real sort of divide and conquer energy going towards the Tea Party. And you almost get a feeling that this election drove things further apart than brought it together. The Republicans took the House. They did not take the Senate. What that means is you're going to have more of a gridlock, more complexity. It's going to be a meaner game. The interestingly enough, the campaign I watched the most, probably because I'm sitting here watching the incredible brochures and ads, is the gubernatorial race in California. We had Meg Whitman, one of the founders of eBay, now worth over $1 billion, spend $140+ million, some commentators saying as much as $160 million, to try and win the governor's race for the Republican ticket, and beaten by Jerry Brown, someone with tremendous experience in California state politics, having served in not just the governorship but other positions before. What was very interesting, and you heard it from a wide number of people out here, real anger that Whitman, if she was willing to spend $140 million of her money, would bother to spend it on running for governor and not just spend it on improving the world. The idea being, if you have that much money and you're willing to spend it, well, who needs to be governor and get eaten up by the machine? Just go do good. You've got the power and the resources to do it. A very interesting article out here this morning, Jude Berry, who's a Democratic strategist in San Jose, who ran one of the campaigns out here, pointed out, let me quote, "The two most successful wealthy businessmen turned politicians, Michael Bloomberg and Los Angeles Mayor Richard Rudin, were liked by the voters because they had given generously to charities. Voters are mildly impressed with people," quote, "voters are mildly impressed with people who make a lot of money and really impressed with people who do good things with it," Barry said. Despite her estimated wealth of $1.2 billion, Whitman had no record of being very charitable. Although Barry says that in the end, money can't buy you love or votes, a leading Republican analyst said the party may have no choice but to keep turning to wealthy candidates. So it appears if you're a wealthy candidate, you better not wait to run to spend some money. You better start contributing to the total economic return before you run to office. And so we have Jerry Brown in office, which is interesting because, if anything, Brown is the nuts and bolts candidate. He's the candidate who knows how the nuts and bolts of state government, the attorney general's office, the treasurer's office, the mayor's office. He's, he's been a mayor as well. He knows Oakland. So this is the guy who knows the nuts and bolts, and it's going to be very interesting to see, how he fares. But the Whitman Brown choice was an interesting one, and the voters ended up coming out for Brown strongly, and Whitman's money boomeranged against her. The Republicans are come with a real mandate from the voters who put them in, many of the, particularly the new, the new players, to change Obamacare, to change health care. And I'm assuming that some of them are sincerely going to try it. It's going to be a very interesting situation because at the heart of the healthcare issue is a whole series of industry players who are planning on using Obamacare to protect their cash flow. So how they're going to deal with the politics of that will be interesting. My hope is the Republicans being present in the House is going to make it trickier and slower and harder to play kick the can with the 401ks and IRAs. But if you look at the fundamental financial issues and the fact that we're going to hit the debt ceiling again in the spring, it's impossible that ultimately this is going to make a long-term difference. The bottom line is where we get a result which I call coagulation. And I'm reminded of a story that I've mentioned before, which is in the summer of 2000, I was visiting the chief of staff to Senator Kit Bond, who was then the chairman of the Small Business Committee in the Senate and also the chairman of the Appropriation Subcommittee for HUD and the 21 agencies, including Treasury. And I was meeting with the chief of staff, and Senator Bond walked in with a plastic cup that had a floater on the bottom, and it was to hold your drink in a swimming pool, so you could put presumably your cocktail in this plastic cup, and it would float around your swimming pool with you, and it had a big straw coming out, sort of goofy looking. And he said, we're doing a fundraiser in St. Louis, next week, and we want to give these as the party favor. What do you think? And I had known him before, and I looked at him and I said, Senator Bond, I think the people giving $1,000 to fund a senator's race expect their senator to be distinguished. And he looked at me with this sadness in his eyes, like, oh, right, remember those days, and kind of walked out. And it gave you the feeling, of course, that after they had pulled all the money out of the country and made the decisions that we've discussed in the 90s, that the power really had left. And that's what we're watching. We're watching an enormous amount of talent, tremendous corporate money, $4 or $5 billion spent on these midterm elections. And so what you've got is an extraordinary squabble, an extraordinary fight over, the corral in which there's going to be a gunfight, and the gunfight have no real bullets, and the corral is really not where the action is. And so it's an awful lot of money, an awful lot of time, an awful lot of strength, and unfortunately the real power and money has left the stage. What will the governors do? Big swing to Republican governors. It's going to be very interesting because now the trench warfare in the cash flows is going to be the game between the federals and the states. And that's why I keep saying if there was one election that was really important this year, it was your sheriff. The Tea Parties really fell victim to the divide and conquer politics, whether it was people's view of them or literally being used as a vehicle for the sort of the bigger money Republican. It's too bad. There was a lot of good stuff starting off in the Tea Party, and a lot of people who were looking to the Tea Party to kind of vent their concern about fundamental liberties and some good issues. you're left with an image of things being very controlled and manipulated at the top. At the same time, what I say is, I know Franklin always says it doesn't matter who's elected. I think, you know, even if the money and the power have to a certain extent left that stage, it's always important. It's always important to have good people in every position. And this is a long-term trench warfare. So I always care, and I always try and vote, although I must admit I failed to get an absentee ballot. So my big contribution this year was on the sheriff's race, where we were very active, and that was finished as of September. Rasmussen wrote a very interesting piece, survey out today. Let me read it to you, and it says sort of my final comment on the elections. Hold the celebration. Most voters expected Republicans to win control of the House of Representatives on Election Day, but nearly as many expected to be disappointed with how they performed by the time the 2012 election rolled around. The new Rasmussen Report National Telephone Survey finds, in fact, that 90% of likely U.S. voters think it is at least somewhat likely that most voters will be disappointed with Republicans in Congress before the next national election. That includes 38%. It is very likely. That's interesting, because what that's showing is we really are getting smarter about understanding sort of the box that the whole system at this point is in. The stories of mortgage fraud just keep coming and coming. The financial blogosphere, in the meantime, it continues to be very vocal and vested in stories of system collapse. I kind of bunched the sort of collapse stories into a couple of different ones. One is the myth of the big release. It's kind of we're going to have a big kaboom, and then things will go back to being rational again, and this Orwellian stuff will stop, and that's sort of one theory. The other is it's kind of the attack of the big failure. The guys who've been thrown out are thrown overboard. Their egos are hurt. They're screaming, those guys are going to fail. Those guys are going to fail, almost as though this is the whack, whack, whack that gets them back in the game. And finally, you have a whole series of people talking about the false flags and the kind of things on the covert side the system has to do if it has to preserve itself. So I just want to say again, I have not changed. I'm 70%. We slow burn through 20 to 25%. We could get another 2008 because there are real leadership issues and real issues in collaborating between Europe and the United States and G20 on managing the debt. We've printed far more debt than anybody can pay. And so how we're going to get out of that is a real dance. So the 2008 scenario could happen again. And again, I give only 5 to 10% chance of collapse. If that happens, it's a political problem, not anything else. We see Kiplinger this week point out one of the things that is going to be most painful for the system to manage, and I just wanted to read it to you. They said, another trend is even more worrisome, growing ranks of the long-term unemployed, would-be earners unable to find a job for over a year. In the years since the recession began, their numbers have swelled from a mere 668,000 to 4.3 million, nearly 3% of the labor force, and almost three times the previous post-war too high of 1% in 1982. Odds are many of them will never work again, because the longer people are out of the market, the more their job skills atrophy. They're not only former factory workers, and then they go through a variety of white-collar jobs that this is also include. The fact is so-called natural unemployment will remain higher for years, and that's bad news on two scores. Having a larger share of the workforce unable to find jobs at any given time keeps pressure on government spending for social programs. So, and ditto, same problem in Europe. So, again, I expect to see the slow burn, but it's, the slow burn is basically the system keeping itself going by throwing people overboard. So it's very, very important when you talk about what could happen in collapse to differentiate between the collapse of the U.S. middle class and the collapse of the military-industrial system. The Fed announcement of $600 billion QE2 has both the stock market and gold shooting up. We see gold closing today. We're trading right now at $1,389, silver at $2,620. Silver's been the real performer, and we're going to have a lot to talk about on next week's Precious Metals Report. food prices are headed up globally. I know I keep saying this to you, but please, 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 I really want everyone to think very creatively about what you can do to ensure you're buying the highest quality food, but watching the impact on your budget. If there was ever a sign of the growing importance of food, it was the announcement this week that Canada has blocked the BHP bid for potash, the world's largest fertilizer producer. Under the Canadian Investment Act, they have fairly flexible latitude to deny a takeover if the transaction won't provide, quote, a net benefit to the country. Well, there's the theme again. I keep talking about the Saleri model and positive total economic return, but it's another reminder. If you're what's good for return to your investors is not perceived to be good for total economic return, it's going to cause you problems one way or another. And so what they're basically saying is they don't think BHP's takeover is going to have a total economic return to the Canadian ecosystem. So there it is. Bond and currency markets, the QE2 announcement has the dollar dropping. There's more to go. Actually, if you look at what's happening with exports, particularly between Europe and the United States, the United States has reasons to want to see the dollar drop, although, you know, certainly not fall off the cliff. As Ireland's borrowing costs skyrocket, the issue of the end game for those who can't print more paper is very real. It's one of the reasons I'm very pleased John Loughlin was able to join us tonight. The sovereign nations break down into two kinds of sovereign nations, sovereign nations with nuclear weapons and advanced weaponries and those without. And the reality is those with can print paper, and as a result they can pump and dump those without. And we're starting to go into the cycle of a meaner squeeze game. And so what's going to happen to the weak sovereign credits in Europe is going to be very interesting to watch. The precious metals market, I'm going to defer again to next week, but I've been more than a little concerned because I've heard the expression over the last week or two, people saying to me, well, you know, the precious metals movement up is over. In fact, we even had Motley Fool publish an article this week saying gold is going to 500. And I'm reminded I had lunch in Santa Monica on a park bench with a wonderful person last week, and they showed up with a T-shirt, which I'm not normally enamored with T-shirts, but this one was one of the best. It had a big writing on the front of it that said, "The beginning is near." Well, the beginning of the long-term bull market in precious metals it's not beginning, but, you know, this is far from over. And the more you understand about the extent of the paper printing, whether currency or bonds, versus the real economy, the more you realize that we are not, this is far, far from over. So that's it for Money and Markets. Ask Catherine some continued great questions. We've had several questions about Fort Knox, and 2 weeks ago published an article about, you know, is the gold in Fort Knox? I defer you to the blog. We also got requests for more information about the annuity proposals for 401k and IRA. David Lichty wrote a marvelous little piece with lots of links. That's a published link on your cart. We'll make it public next week for the general public. We're working now on a Saleri report on tax issues on shifting gold and silver between accounts and depository holdings. So look for that before our Saleri report next week. Last week, David published one on just an introduction to Cougarants. We're going to continually try and do one or two a month on specific coins that are very popular. A question on whether or not I like numismatics in this environment. Numismatics is a coin that generally trades at a high premium over melt value because of some perceived value, including the notion that it may be free from confiscation. I don't like numismatics in any market. So, and we've talked about, if you go back into your precious metals library, you'll see where Franklin and I have covered that several times before if you're interested for more. Several questions on gold money and the foreign financial forms, foreign bank and financial account forms known as FBAR 2010. we wrote a very detailed report updating our FBAR reports that I published on the blog. In June 6, 2010, if you just go to the blog in a little search function and do a search for FBAR or for foreign bank and financial accounts, you'll pull it up. I would recommend that you take a look at that. We continue to believe that the more conservative position is you do need to file an FBAR form for a gold money account, and again, I refer you to that blog post. Others would take the position that you don't, but we show you the original source material as to why we take that position, and we defer to your CPA or tax attorney. They should be the judge. A great comment: can Catherine schedule a qualified speaker such as a tax attorney or CPA, since part of the Solaria financial strategy appears to involve holding foreign assets such as gold money? We need to keep alert to changes in required filings, deadlines, and penalties. We will do that. Our one concern is that the new rules from the financial reform bill are going into effect, and tax preparers are having to file with the IRS. And my feeling, and these are my words, not their words, is that I now believe that the tax preparers are legally, in essence, an enforcement arm of the IRS. And that obligation supersedes their ethical obligation to their client. And so that certainly takes many of the good tax attorneys or CPAs and literally ties their hands and makes it much more difficult for them to speak in public. But we will certainly keep an eye out for them, for someone who can do that. Another question: can you say something about the Nordic situation in terms of pension savings and related? Great question. I've had one of our staff researching that question and really feel that I've not been able to come up with enough information on what's in the pension funds. In this question specifically went to Finland. And I would just ask if anybody has information on the links to that or can make suggestions as where our research can take us, I would welcome it. I'm very interested in the Nordic credits. I think they, as they go, they're some of the finest credits in the sovereign bond world. In part, Norway has the advantage of an extraordinary sovereign wealth fund because of their natural resource wealth. But I would love to know more about what they have really been buying in the pension funds and what the condition of the pension funds are. So I would welcome any links you want to send. In addition, a question: T-bills will convert an emergency to 30-year bonds by the government. Is this true? We've looked everywhere. We've looked at the U.S. Code, the Code of Regulations. We've looked at executive orders, emergency presidential declarations, provisions in pending legislation, and have found nothing. If you have any legal documentation on this, we would certainly welcome it. Now, I would also point out, in a serious sovereign bond emergency or a kind of bailout situation, a lot is possible, although I think there are other provisions that takes out current T-bills and gets them into 30-year bonds that are much easier to do than trying to change the terms of existing entity or paper. Okay, another great question. If Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac are poor choices for investments, how would their bonds become worthless? What would be happening within the agency's government or market that would have that happen? So many bond funds have these agency bonds or government bonds in their portfolio. Why might the managers consider these good investments? Right now, if you look at the backstop by the federal government of Fannie and Freddie, in essence, most credit analysts are assuming that these enjoy a federal government guarantee. The government has said it's going to pick up the deficit. Now, they certainly do not enjoy the full faith and credit of the U.S. Treasury or some of the U.S. agencies. But essentially what most managers are figuring is it's the equivalent of buying U.S. Treasury, but you get yourself better yield, and there's some other minor advantages. Now, the question is this really a reasonable assumption? We have we have Barney Frank leaving, of course, in the House as the head of the key congressional committee overseeing banks and housing finance, and we have Spencer Baucus coming in as chairman of the Housing Finance Services, or at least expected to, replacing Frank. And he's literally now saying that the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac should be in liquidation, not conservatorship. When the chairman of your authorizing committee is saying you should be liquidated, it means the politics are fluid, because the reality is these are entities that have no fundamental economics behind them. They have politics behind them at this point, particularly if the fraud is anywhere near as great as I think it might be in those portfolios. And I think you're always standing on shaky ground when you're depending on pure politics. Now, that said, in almost all scenarios, the federal government is far better off for printing your way out of troubles on Fannie and Freddie instead of playing kick the can and playing fast and furious with the creditors. The reality exists that in a real tricky time, which we could be in maybe not this year, but 2011, 2012, we could see a situation where the smart money knows to get out, the retail stays in, and Lord knows what could happen. But again, the likely thing is inflation. My feeling on all of this is if I don't want to put money into something that's turning around and putting money into something that has a negative total economic return, which in my, I'm convinced Freddie and Fannie does. If you imagine a world where local banks hold mortgages, you imagine a world where local banks have a reason to make sure that mortgage fraud and drug dealing stays out of a community. It's really centralizing the mortgages with federal credit that creates the conditions of insane economics being not only permitted but encouraged in neighborhoods. You really break alignment between people and money. And frankly, I just don't want money going in there. Now, the challenge is if you're using bond funds and not individual funds, it's hard to avoid. And so it's, you know, in some cases it's difficult to be perfect. But I think our general rule here is stick with fundamental economics and avoid being dependent on politics. If you look at many, many portfolios, what you will see is lots of different stocks and bonds. However, if you dig deep and you look at the real credit of those companies and where their profits are coming from and those bonds and where their subsidies are coming from, you're basically talking about zero diversification. You're talking about an entire portfolio with literally, counting the funds, thousands of stocks and bonds, all of which are essentially a United States Treasury bill. In other words, you're talking about many different operations that are entirely political dependent, and you're not on solid ground. And so you want to make sure you are. Okay, that's it for Ask Questions. Great questions. Keep them coming. And now, will the euro fail? It's past 2 a.m. in Paris, so we recorded John this morning at the end of his day, but while he was still wide awake. So we're now going to run that interview for you. It's my pleasure to introduce John Loughlin, who is an author, an historian, a philosopher. He's British by background, but serves now as the Director of Studies at the Institute of Democracy and Cooperation in Paris. He's the author of many books, all of which I recommend to you, but particularly The Tainted Source, The Undemocratic Origins of the European Idea. And John, it's just a pleasure to welcome you to the Solari Report. Thank you. I know it's the end of the day in Paris. Thank you for coming in.
Not at all. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Well, I heard you in 2001 predict everything that's happening now. I'll just say it that way. And maybe if you could take us back to your original writings on the European Union, talk a little bit about how the European Union came to be and why it was possible to foresee the problems we're looking at today.
Well, it's very kind of you to say I predicted everything. Of course, if I had predicted it, including with the right dates, I think I'd be a very rich man. That's always the problem, isn't it? When you identify a weakness, a political weakness or an economic weakness, you might be right about the general tendency, but the trick is to know when things are going to happen. But in some senses, thank you, you are right. I think that the European Union does have structural weaknesses, which will sooner or later prove fatal to the whole project. In other words, they are such that the project cannot last. The European Union obviously came into being in 1957. It was built on the earlier coal and steel community created in 1951. And as the dates suggest, its origins lie really in the Cold War. It was a largely US-sponsored trading and political and economic bloc. I say US-sponsored because some Europeans imagined that it was created as a rival to the United States, and I've never believed that to be true. But anyway, it was a Cold War creation which expanded dramatically after the end of the Cold War, albeit not immediately so, and now, of course, has 27 member states. And it's responded to successive waves of enlargement. It originally had six member states, and then it went to 9 and 12 and 15. Now, as I say, it has 27. It's responded to these successive waves of enlargement by increasing centralization of power. That's really the bottom line. The centralization of power has been going on now dramatically since the mid-1980s, and it takes the form, quite simply, of transferring more and more competences and more powers to the European level in the absence of any democratic control over these powers. And by the way, in the deliberate absence of any democratic control, it's absolutely clear when you study the way that European leaders behave that one of their main purposes in building the European Union was precisely to escape from democratic control. The European Union allows European leaders, national leaders, to make policy and laws without having to subject them to parliamentary scrutiny. That's the basic constitutional trick about the European Union. It does that because laws in the European Union are made by the governments. So it's a great trick, really, for governments to obtain lawmaking powers.
Right.
And the other way that there is centralization is by transferring power to bureaucracies, to administrative organs, bureaucracies which are not elected and not accountable. The most famous one is, of course, the European Commission, which has been in place ever since the EU was created, which is a bureaucracy, but it has far greater powers than any other bureaucracy in any democracy. And the second organization, which is extremely important, I think, for our discussion today, is obviously the European Central Bank, because when the euro was created in 1999, the member states, there were then 11, there are now 16, transferred their monetary policy to a central organization. And now they decide their monetary policy independently, both of their respective national governments, but also, I would say, irrespective of their national electorates. So to sum up, at every stage, there's been centralization, and it's centralization which I emphasize is anti-democratic in nature. And that's the source of the fatal weakness of the European project.
And it's also, when you have a centralized currency like that, it's also, it's not only undemocratic, but it's not thoughtful to different economies. So you have
exactly.
Very different economies within the European Union, and it can be remarkably destabilizing to both the strong and the weak, because they can't. There's a whole group of things you can solve with different currencies that now you can, and the currency can just wreak havoc with the different economies.
Yes, and the other side, I mean, obviously that's one very important point. Interest rates are the same for these widely differing economies.
Right.
But the existence of the Eurozone has also had another effect, which I think your listeners, I'm sure, know about, which is, and which indeed was predicted at the time by Eurosceptics, in other words, people who were sceptic of the project of monetary union, and that is that because there is now one single currency area, states are encouraged to borrow recklessly.
Right.
Because the normal effect of borrowing recklessly would, of course, be to weaken the national currency. But when you share a currency with other states, then you basically have the free rider problem, whereby states can borrow as much as they like, safe in the knowledge that their borrowing is only a small percentage of the overall euro debt, and therefore they can get away with a lot more than they perhaps would have been able to do if they had national currencies. Now, That may have been their gamble, but the gamble hasn't paid off, or at least it's in the process of unraveling. And this is what we refer to, of course, as the crisis in the Eurozone. The fact is that the weak countries, particularly Greece, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal, are saddled with levels of debt, which they are literally finding it impossible to repay. They simply can't raise enough money in tax to pay the interest repayments. Because, of course, as you know, again, as your listeners know, although the currency is shared, the bond prices, the borrowing prices for respective governments depend on the country in question. So Ireland, for instance, today, literally today, the 4th of November, its bond yields have hit a record high, I think, of 7.36%. In other words, Ireland is paying a gigantic premium to borrow money over the benchmark rate for the borrowing by Germany.
Well, you know, what we saw in Europe is the same thing we saw here, which is you have the strong economies pumping currency, and it's flowing, you know, sort of hot money, bubble paper flowing into these weaker places. And the, you know, the question that's being grappled with here as people in America watch Europe is, you know, because we always want to find out who's to blame. Is it the banks transferring the hot money, or is it the country itself?
Oddly enough, one of the causes of the Eurozone crisis, such as it's unfolded in the last year and a half, 2 years, has in fact been, in one respect, a cut in such transfers. Because one of the effects of enlargement in 2004 to include new states from Eastern Europe was to restructure radically the agricultural budget of the European Union. Mm-hmm. And countries like Spain and Portugal, which had been used to receiving billions of subsidy and agricultural subsidy every year, suddenly found their budget cut. And this is one of the factors underlying the present crisis. They didn't expect to suddenly find themselves out of pocket, mm-hmm. and yet they are. Of course what you say in your question is true. There are these transfers from rich countries to poor. And there is, above all, the danger and fear that the richer countries will have to bail out the poorer ones.
Right.
But the relationship is not totally, it's not a totally one-way relationship. The fact is that Germany, which obviously is the largest economy and in some respects the strongest, has a very strong interest in maintaining the euro in place. You can't say, it would be quite wrong to say, or at least a perceived interest, whether the interest is real, it might be another question, but certainly the political class in Germany and the economic class, which is perhaps even more important, believes that it has a very strong interest in maintaining the euro. Why? Because the exchange rate at which the Deutsche Mark was transformed into the euro, the exchange rate between it and the other euro currencies, was very favorable to German exports.
Mm-hmm.
And by creating the single currency area, Germany has managed to create for itself a captive market where the countries receiving German exports effectively have overvalued currencies. In other words, where they are paying more for their German exports. The amount that the Germans get for their exports is higher than it would otherwise be, the German mm-hmm. currency being relatively undervalued. So Germany has a very, being of course heavily reliant on exports, it may of course balk at being required to bail out Greeks and so on, whom Germans regard as a bunch of lazy Southern European layabouts. But at the same time, it would be quite wrong for the Germans to think that they hadn't benefited from this arrangement. On the contrary, Germany has done very well in a period when otherwise the European economy has been quite sluggish.
Right. Right. Well, you know, the one of the things I see as I travel around the world is that we all are underestimating our benefits and overestimating our abuses.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you're the German leadership, how do you manage that benefit at the same time? I mean, I would imagine that the German people are livid at the idea of having to bail out more, whether they perceive it to be more Greeks or more banks.
They are, and this is, and not only the Germans. The Dutch as well, Dutch politics is going through a very interesting period and has been now for nearly half a decade. So yes, that's absolutely right. And this really, I think, is the key to the Eurozone crisis. You see, the idea was, it's a very stupid idea and it was one I attacked at the time, but the idea was that by having a single currency, the Europeans would learn to love each other more. Well, of course, it's proved not to be a factor for unity. It's
right.
proved to be precisely the opposite.
Right.
As frankly, as I say, anyone could have predicted. Precisely because these disparate economies have been forced into a one single monetary straitjacket, the mutual dislike and resentment has grown. So the euro, in a political sense, has precisely become a factor for division and not a factor for unity. And that really is the bottom line with the euro. The euro has now, in my view, become a problem rather than a solution. I mean, I always think it was a problem, but it's now, I think, increasingly obvious that it's a political problem rather than a political solution.
What I see happening in Europe, John, is the same thing I see happening in North America, although it's in different forms. But that is, you have a political leadership that's centralizing, that wants to centralize.
Yeah.
That centralization has destabilized. It's hurt the economy in many, many ways. Their response is to want to centralize more.
Absolutely. I strongly agree that the problems are the same. I absolutely don't buy this easy comment, which is often read in the English language press, in other words, in Britain and in America, that there is somehow on the one side of the Atlantic this amazing, thrusting American economy, and on the other side this unbelievably sluggish European one. On the contrary, of course there are differences, but the differences are perhaps ones of degree. They're certainly not ones of kind. All these industrialized countries are facing effectively identical problems. And as you've said in your question, they respond to them in the same way, by centralizing, by trying to take more and more power to the center, and by trying to, also you haven't mentioned this yet, but by trying to borrow more and more. I mean, this is the other issue which unites, not just the industrial world, probably the whole world, but certainly the two sides of the Atlantic, is, of course, the question of debt, both state debt and private debt. And in that respect, the problems that we are seeing in Europe are literally identical to the ones we see in America. The debt issue, of course, is particularly bad in, as we know, in the countries I mentioned earlier, Greece, Spain, Portugal, and particularly Ireland. But it's also very bad in the United Kingdom, in Britain, which has chronic levels of debt run up, incidentally, mainly by the previous government, which has just left office. But it has run up levels of debt which I think are close to and possibly even exceed the levels of debt in Greece. It's talked about slightly less because obviously Britain isn't part of the euro, but nonetheless the levels of debt are very, very high.
It's funny, I was in London in June and everything just seemed swimming. Everything just seemed fine and, economy cooking along. And, I've almost reached the point where I wonder if debt is not really just a central control system as opposed to an economic system. So,
well, I think you can get that impression. I mean, much as I'm speaking to you from central Paris, you can get the impression that things are going very well. And, of course, in the great scheme of things, they are. I mean, people are relatively prosperous, much as they are in the United States. There are no really serious problems. There may be problems of urban decay. There may be a looming pensions crisis and so on. It's not as if war is about to break out or if people are going to die in the streets. And certainly in the major capitals, you will get a sense of great prosperity. But you don't need to travel far in France, certainly, to see really a pretty big change.
You go to the rural areas and you're in a depression.
Yeah, right?
Exactly. The blood's being drawn to the center.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, well, indeed, your theme of centralization applies here because, obviously, yes, riches are are drawn, are being effectively sucked out of the countryside into the urban areas. And that's one reason why, of course, we have, but this is a very long trend, why we have such enormous cities now and why there is rural depopulation.
When I was back in Europe in September, and I spent a fairly long time talking to several business people, and what came out, I was sitting and listening to someone describe the pension arrangements in Europe, and here I've been very focused, John, on the extent to which money has been shifted out of the pension funds and phony paper has been, and fraudulent paper, including mortgage paper, has been shifted in.
Yeah.
And we're grappling here with something that really hasn't become clear yet in the psyche, which is whether it's the governmental benefits in the form of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, or the private pension funds. You have an entire generation of baby boomers who have enormous expectations. And in fact, if you look at there all these different arrangements, there's no there behind them. Or, you know, there's a lot less than is supposed to be. And part of the politics is managing the expectations. And the politicians don't really have a plan for that. They're just kind of playing kick the can and continuing to play their old games. And I realized as I was listening, oh, my word, it's the same picture in Europe.
That's right. Although it's not totally accurate to talk about pension systems in Europe because,
right,
of course, they're run in very different ways. In Britain, yes, what you describe is absolutely right. But that's a problem that's about 10 years old by now under Gordon Brown. When Gordon Brown was Chancellor, the pension system largely collapsed in Britain. He started to tax the pension funds in ways that hadn't been taxed before. And this finished a lot of them off. There was a particularly spectacular crash of one pension fund in the middle of the last decade. Indeed, it's, I think, common knowledge that the United Kingdom is heading towards a terrible pensions crisis, largely because to the extent that people have saved at all, which in many cases they haven't, it's very common for people not to have pensions or savings of any kind. To the extent that they've saved, a lot of them have saved in property. And what we're seeing in Britain now, I mean, not saved in property, but they own a property typically, and they,
right,
hope that somehow it will, you know, provide for them in their old age. Well, this is one of the big factors driving, as in America, driving the monetary creation that's going on in England and in America. The primary imperative is to get the housing prices to rise again, even in nominal terms, even in terms of inflated currency.
Right.
I mean, that's, as I see it, what is happening now with the Fed's decision to buy debt and with the Bank of England's similar decision to engage in quantitative easing. They are determined to create inflation in property prices and indeed in the stock market. And if the only way of doing that is by debasing the currency, that's what they're going to do. Precisely because, as you say, it is about maintaining expectations, or rather the illusion that people are continuing to have wealth. The British particularly, I don't know, I'm not familiar with how it is in America, but the British are absolutely obsessed with the value of their houses. And they only feel good if the value of that house is so-called going up in nominal terms.
Right.
So even if it's in debased currency, they're happy if the prices of their property are going up. It's an absolutely suicidal policy. It's a suicidal policy, not least because it sucks money out of the real economy.
Right.
Obviously, if property prices keep rising, then the price of everything has to keep rising. But as you know, there is this obsession with property prices, which means that politically the imperative is on to drive up inflation. Now, in France, there's a slightly different situation. We've seen very significant demonstrations here against the raising of the retirement age. The raising has gone ahead, and you know, that will, the government's policy will now be implemented. But there's been a lot of, again, there's been a lot of rather silly comment in the English language media about this. People saying, "Oh, it's classic French socialist reaction to want the state to take care of them after the age of 62 or whatever, and, you know, why can't they carry on working for another couple of years?" But what I think these criticisms fail to understand is that a raise in the retirement age is quite simply a raise in taxes.
Right.
In other words, because you are forced to work longer and to pay taxes or pay contributions for longer in order to get what is called the full pension. So a rise in the retirement age is quite simply a rise in taxes. So these protests that have been sneered at by Anglo-American commentators, at the same time as they welcome the Tea Party protests against raising taxes in America,
right,
seem to me to be completely hypocritical. On the contrary, they're exactly the same thing.
Well, it's interesting. You have an entire society that's behaved on a non-accountable basis. So,
yes.
For example, in America, you know, everyone on the ground in neighborhoods and counties is going along with a housing bubble, or almost everyone.
Yes.
And
yes.
So you're having a party at the grassroots level that's clearly not financially sustainable and not financially healthy, and you're
yes.
having a party on Wall Street and Washington, and it's very easy for each group to look at the other and say,
yeah.
You know, you've behaved badly. The reality
yeah.
is both parties behave badly, and one's getting bailed out and the other isn't.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very good way of putting it. And,
yeah.
of course, this property bubble is precisely what has caused the crisis in the Eurozone because, again, we must forget all this nonsense about, sclerotic European economies versus thrusting Anglo-Saxon power ones. Because the property bubble has taken place
everywhere.
Ireland, Spain,
yeah,
and to a large extent in the United Kingdom. In other words, in Ireland, which is a Euro country, in Spain, which is a Euro country, and of course in Britain, which isn't. So that is precisely what has led. The problems in Spain are directly linked, as they are in Ireland, not so much in Greece or Portugal, but in Spain and Ireland, they are directly linked to a mad housing bubble in both those countries, which burst about 2 years ago.
Well, and it's funny, you see this globally. When you print money, whether through currency or debt, particularly governmental debt securities, what you do is, without creating anything new in the real economy of any import other than some larger houses, and when you do that, you get a massive misallocation of capital.
Mm.
And it's not just in Europe, it's not just in North America, it's globally. And in fact, our solution to these kinds of, you know, mad paper misallocations is now with QE2 here in the United States to print more paper. And if you're in the Eurozone and we're printing paper, then what are you going to do? I mean,
well, I'm glad you asked that question because I don't want our discussion to finish without making two very important points. The first is that Europe really is a bystander in what's happening. You know, we're talking now, you and I, about the crisis in the Eurozone, but Europe is precisely not an actor, not an active actor in what's
right.
going on in the world economy at the moment. And this, again, by the way, is another great paradox about the euro, because the euro was supposed to make Europe into a or at least the Eurozone countries into a major player in the international, you know, monetary game.
For decades, for my whole life, if you talk to an American leader, American business person, they'll say, we control access to what is now 300 million consumers, that's real power. And I think part of what they were thinking was if you had the Eurozone, then you would similarly have that kind of block of consumer that would rival the U.S.
Yeah, well, of course they did, ultimately, it's not a totally bad idea.
Right.
There are huge problems associated with the dominance of the dollar in the world financial system. The problem is that they didn't tackle the problem at its basis, which of
right.
course is the existence of paper currency. That's another subject, which I expect many of your listeners are probably far better up on that than I am. But anyway, they wanted to make themselves into a major player, and it's failed. Why has it failed? Quite simply because Europe is sandwiched between what everyone is now calling the imminent currency war, or currency wars. The term has been used by the IMF. It's made its way within a matter of weeks into the standard vocabulary. Europe is in the middle of this currency war about to break out between the United States and China. And the reason why Europe is not an active player in this currency war is that it, and this brings me to my second point, is that in spite of the centralization and of the centralized appearance of the euro, in fact, when you look at it more closely, the structure of the euro is dangerously decentralized. What I mean by dangerously decentralized, I certainly don't welcome centralization, but what I mean is that the system is structured in such a way that it simply, I don't believe, can resist. It simply cannot resist major external shocks, such as, for instance, a rapid appreciation in the price of the euro. Let me just say what I mean by that. What I mean is that whereas in the United States or in any ordinary country, you have one central bank and one currency, that central bank issues the currency and performs the function of lender of last resort. Those are the definitions of a central bank. Plus, of course, the country is, the monetary policy of the central bank is, even in the case of independent banks, is in some respects embedded in the overall fiscal policy of the state. The European Central Bank, by contrast, does not have either of these two functions. It is neither a lender of last resort, nor does it even issue currency. This is the most important point, I think, when people are trying to understand why the euro may break up. The fact is that the euro is only in appearance a single currency. It is, in fact, 16 national currencies produced by 16 national central banks who happen to all print the same-looking banknotes. But they physically print them themselves. They physically put a secret code on each of them to identify their national origin. And all that they do in common is to decide together what the single interest rate will be in that currency zone. But it is they, the national banks, the national central banks, who continue, in fact, to be the engineers of monetary policy, bound together, as it happens now, by treaty. But what that means is that if there is a major external shock, and if the political will comes about that that a country should leave the euro, then in technical terms it is quite easy for it to do so. There may be other costs associated with leaving it. I'm sure there are in all cases. But technically it's very simple. These countries have not abolished their central banks, and they haven't even ceased to be issuers of currency. On the contrary, they all continue to issue currency. It just so happens they all issue the same currency. So in technical terms, in structural terms, the structure, although centralized in terms of power, is actually decentralized in terms of implementation.
And if you're going to do a bailout, like the Greek bailout, that's an awful lot of people to get into a consensus in a crisis.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for the time being, there has been consensus to perform this bailout, and it's gone ahead. But as I say, that was for Greece. The situation in Ireland is worse than in Greece. Everybody understands that. The debt levels are higher. The bond yields have just broken through a record and so on. So, but everyone understands that there can't be a second bailout. On the contrary, the European leaders are now trying to write new rules to say that there won't be another bailout. I don't think anyone will believe them. But, you know, if a crisis, I won't say erupts because we're in crisis already, but if a country like Ireland runs into very serious difficulties, it already is, but if these difficulties get even more serious, then what are the European leaders going to do?
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, John, was because I sat in 2001 at that wonderful conference in London, and you and I heard Anne Williamson talk about literally the devastation of Russia in the 90s economically.
Yeah.
And I know now, you know, in between the dance between the United States and China is Russia right in the middle. And, of course, a lot of our presence in Eurasia relates to, you know, the U.S.'s position vis-a-vis Russia and China. So how does Russia play into everything that's going on in Europe? I mean, they're sitting there. We have very astute leadership sitting there watching this dance. And
well, that's a political question, which I'm very happy to answer. And I think the answer is as follows, is that there are tentative attempts, by Western European leaders to bring Russia closer into the fold. But at the same time, there are also fairly warm relations between Russia and Washington. So, yes, Russia is becoming closer to Europe. I work for a Russian think tank, so this is a question that I spend a lot of time thinking about. But also, there has been a considerable improvement in relations between Moscow and Washington ever since Obama's election. So Russia is keen to be drawn in, or at least keen to get closer to both Europe and America. In fact, the Russian president is going to the NATO summit in Lisbon in a couple of weeks, which is a unprecedented event and underlines the fact that, you know, the Russians are keen in good relations with both sides. Obviously, in geopolitical terms, the question is, will a greater Russian role in Europe lead to a reduction of an American role? And obviously, I think that that's the way things are going, but we're dealing here with quite long-term trends.
Right.
Russia is a powerful country. It's a powerful country militarily, but its power, its economic power, is obviously not by any means the same as its geographical size or its military capacity. Although the Russian economy has been very good for the last 10 years, they took a big hit during the financial crisis as well. And in any case, their economy has, you know, plenty of problems. It's an economy that's more like the economy of Brazil or somewhere like that. Well, not that I know much about the Brazilian economy, but it's an economy that, as everyone knows, is excessively based on the export of primary materials.
Right.
This,
although
by the way,
if the U.S. has to keep the oil price high to checkmate China, that's good for Russia.
Absolutely, that Russia has done very well out of a high oil price. It's just that it's not an optimum form of economic development. And you know, goodness me, if we're saying that you need to only drive 100 miles out of Paris or Washington D.C. to find depression, well, I can tell you that's definitely true of Russia. Moscow may be a economic powerhouse, but you hardly need to drive for an hour or so before you really are back in, you know, quite severely depressed rural areas.
I'll tell you, Jennifer, you can twist the knife with elegance like you can.
So, I mean, to sum up, I think that, you know, obviously Russia and Europe have huge amounts in common, and I very much hope that, I wish it would have happened earlier, and I'm very frustrated that the Cold War has continued, really, for 20 years after it ended, in the sense that under successive American administrations, first Clinton, then Bush's two administrations, relations were terrible. And I largely blame, I mean, the Europeans are guilty too, but I mainly blame Washington for continuing to nourish this division. And obviously,
well, our economy is deeply dependent on war, whether it's COVID or
over. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Of course it is.
Now,
so that's a major problem. But obviously, you know, in the long, in the great scheme of things, there should be, because after all, Europe, I mean, all of what I've said about the Russian economy is true, but nonetheless, the fact is that Europe needs energy. It's an energy importer. Russia has it. Russia is next to us. So, you know, it's, as you say in America, it's a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah. Now, tell us what's next. We're coming, you know, we've just finished the elections here. We have the Federal Reserve announcing QE2. You know, between now and spring, what do you predict for Europe and the management of the extraordinary geopolitics in this debt situation?
Well, I don't think I'm not really expecting much to change between now and next spring. I mean, I'm not a professional forecaster, so I don't advise anyone to take that take it for what it's worth. But I think the problem in the short term is that monetarily, and that's what matters, you have a sort of competition, a sort of downward competition between, various bad currencies, the United States dollar, the British pound sterling, the euro, and no doubt also the Japanese and Chinese currencies. And everyone is determined to avoid their currency rising too much, because they're all hoping, of course, certainly Europe and China, they're hoping to carry on exporting. So when we look at these various monetary systems, all of which have fatal flaws, it's quite difficult to know which one is going to break up first.
Hit the floor first.
Yeah, you know, I mean, on paper, the American system shouldn't fly. It should have crash landed a long time ago. It doesn't make sense for these gigantic gazillion, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in debt to be monetized. That just doesn't make economic sense. But equally, as I've said earlier, the euro doesn't make political sense either.
Right.
So it's a sort of competition, really, between various systems which don't make sense. But for the time being, I mean, if you're asking me, as I say, between now and next spring, I'm not expecting a major crisis, although I wouldn't be surprised if little by little the outlines become clear. But once again, I think it's mainly between the United States and China. I think that's really where the action is going to be. And Europe is effectively a bystander.
Right. Or squeezed in the middle.
Squeezed in the middle, yeah.
The challenge we've got is the real economy really does need currencies to trade. And the, you know, part of the solution to the debt problem is to ensure that the real economy is healthy. And the problem is we've got currencies now that are part of a political centralization. And you know, some of the countries are deeply dependent, the U.S. is deeply dependent on financial speculation as an industry.
Yes,
so are we going to use our currencies for manipulation and speculation or in sort of economic warfare? Are we going to use them to trade?
No, they're going to be used for speculation and above all for inflation. I have absolutely no doubt about that at all. As I said a few minutes ago, there is a major political imperative, certainly in Britain, probably in America, to see certain figures going up, property prices, stock market, and so on. And that will be done at any price.
Right.
That is the only thing that will guarantee re-election. Is if people think wrongly, but if they think that their portfolio is going up in debased currency. So there's a massive imperative for inflation, a massive imperative which is bolstered, of course, by the debt. Everyone has big debts. A lot of people have large private debts, but above all, the states themselves have huge debts. The only way out of that is to inflate. But again, everyone's in the same boat, and that's why I think that we're dealing with a competition between almost equally bad systems.
Well, John, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Solari. Thank you so much for taking time out of the end of your day.
And, not at all.
We look forward to seeing your writings and comments. Are you writing for any of the periodicals, or is it just sporadic?
I'm writing for periodicals sporadically. I write occasionally for the I started to write occasional pieces for Newsmax in the States.
Okay.
I occasionally write for the American Conservative, although there's been a editorial team change there, so my contacts have gone. And in Britain, I write occasionally for the Mail and the Spectator. But
any more books in the works?
I have written another book, but my last three books have all been on war crimes trials. And on the problems associated with prosecutions for war crimes.
Uh-huh.
So I have indeed now written another book on the International Criminal Court, but it hasn't been published yet.
Okay. Well, I look forward to getting it and reading it. Have a wonderful day. Thank you again so much.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Okay.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye now.
Okay. That's John Loughlin, a wonderful source of great insight on what's really going on. Quickly, let's go to the movies. Inside Job, I can't recommend it enough. It's a 2010 current new in the theaters documentary by Charles Ferguson. It's very well narrated by Matt Damon. It's on the financial crisis of 2008, what happened, and you really step back and see the extent to which this was systemically engineered in a very top-down way. One of the amazing things about it is people who think they have no interest in going to see such a documentary get dragged there and end up really enjoying it and recommending it. So you don't need to be a financial person at all. Ferguson got some great interviews. I don't agree with everything, but it's we're putting together the pieces of a puzzle, and he brings some of the pieces and does a brilliant job of doing it. Some great and very interesting interviews. And one of the things he nails, and I love him for this, is he captures the importance of a corrupt academic establishment in helping provide the intellectual air cover for this kind of fraud. And he just nails them. It's great. And so that's a very important part of the piece. And if you're going to stop this kind of financial fraud, you really have to clean up academia or stop giving them the credit that they certainly don't deserve. But it really does give you a sense of what happened. And it's very entertaining and interesting. And so especially if you like documentaries, it's in the theater now. And I'm sure it won't be long until it's, you know, available on DVD and at Netflix. So Inside Job, I recommend it. Coming up, for those in Palo Alto, before I leave next week, I'm going to be speaking at the Future Salon at SAP in Palo Alto. If you're in the Silicon Valley area, check out the more details either on our events page or at futuresalon.org. I'm going to be talking about positive futures for the financial side of life, including some recommendations for Jerry Brown and his team on how California can revive local economies. Then I'm headed out next week for Tennessee. I'm going to be doing the Precious Metals Market Report from Franklin Sanders Farm, and we have much to talk about. So I'll also be driving cross-country, talking to people along the way and getting a sense, again, of what's going on the ground. Then I'm headed for Philadelphia, where I'll be working through the end of the year. Coming up on November 18th, that following week, Axel Merck of the Merck Funds, no one better to talk about the international fixed income and currency markets. Axel Merck, a wonderful commentator and very astute investment manager. On December 2nd, Charles Murray, president of the American Institute of Economic Research in Massachusetts, I'm a member, wonderful source of economic analysis and financial planning. They have a book I want to cover. It's a little check, sort of workbook checklist. Everybody should get a copy. It's called If Something Should Happen, and it helps you organize your affairs and documentation for a disability or an accident, a wonderful financial planning tool. So just helping us get organized into the January period when a lot of families do their budget and plan. Remember, David Lichty, Paul Ferguson, and I at Solaria Silver and Gold want to help you protect yourself against the currency debasement underway, so feel free to call and let us see if we can help you. And until next week, when I'm doing Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders from Tennessee, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.